Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
What they did, it was still political interference. They did favor to us. They communicated to us through that action that we are under pressure. We are being intimidated. That is the reason why those things came out like that, because they have no legal right to do what they did.
A former Zambian parliamentarian says the country's electoral commission was wrong for rejecting his nomination to compete in the upcoming by-election.
Specifically, what we find they're saying, I think 81% is an extremely overwhelming majority, is that they are concerned about ongoing gender-based violence and femicide on the continent. They're concerned about gender equality and the rule of law in regards to the protection of women's rights.
A survey shows a majority of Africa's youth want action to stop gender-based violence.
It gladdens the heart to also inform you that concerted efforts are being put on as we speak currently to put all these issues behind us and to focus on the 2023 election, in which the Waziri Adamawa Atiku Abubakar is the candidate of the People's Democratic Party.
And supporters of Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, expressed concern about reports of divisions within its leadership ahead of next year's general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Zambia, a former parliamentarian says the country's electoral commission was wrong for rejecting his nomination to compete in the upcoming election in Kabushi constituency. Bowman Lusambo, who is from the main opposition Patriotic Front, or PF, says he is confident a decision by the Constitutional Court will vindicate his stance. His remarks come after the Electoral Commission of Zambia refused to accept the nomination of Lusambo, citing a constitutional provision it says bars him from competing in the vote. The Constitutional Court had nullified Lusambo's election last year, citing voter irregularities and violence. The by-election is scheduled for September 15. For more on the latest development, I read Bowman Lusambo. He is a former parliamentarian from the Kabushi constituency.
The Deputy Commission of Zambia, it is just a referee. It is an autonomy body. And they have got no right. They have got no right to do what they did. What they did, it was still have political interference. They did favor to us. They communicated to us through that action that we are under pressure. We are being intimidated. That is the reason why those things came out like that. Because they have no right. They have no legal rights to do what they did. And the constitution which they quoted, it was a wrong constitution whatsoever. And wrong quotas for us. That's why our legal team, they went to the Crown Court on Monday somewhere there for a hearing. Then on the 7th, there will be judgment.
By the time the Constitutional Court decides on your case on the 7th of September, nomination would have closed. Basically, some people say that that renders you unable to compete in the upcoming by-elections.
No, the Constitutional Court, they have the right and the power even to call for fresh nominations, because those nominations which were conducted, they will be cancelled and call for fresh ones. Because happened yesterday, it is a very sad development. It's a black cloud upon our country where the rule of law is concerned, human rights. It was a very sad day for us.
Some people are of the view that if you are the cause of the nullification of an election for which the by-election has been ordered, then you do not necessarily qualify. According to Zambia Constitution, this is what your critics are saying, that you should not even be allowed to stand as a candidate because you are the cause of the nullification of the election in the first place.
In the first place, Peter, I did not cause any vacancy in the parliament. I did not do that. My opponents, they went to court, and it's not me who went to court. They are mistaken in this article. You know, reading is very important, and knowledge is power. I participated in the 2016 nomination amendment. And what we did, Peter, what we did, the issue to do with Article 72.4, it has the number of cases or the list of issues. One, if one crossed the floor, crossing the floor, Peter, in parliament means I dissent from my party, going to another party. There, I have caused a vacancy, and I cannot be allowed to stand. Two, if I resign from my political party, I resign, then I have caused that vacancy. So the issue of Article 72.4, it is misplaced, and we are not affected with that article.
So, Lusambo, what realistically are your chances of success at the Constitutional Court?
We believe in the rule of law, and we believe in democracy, and those men and women in the judiciary, they know that they have to protect this country, they have to protect the democracy, and they'll have to operate within the rule of law. So the chances are very high. We have more than 100 or 200% chances in the concourse, because the issue at hand, simple and straightforward. And it will be very easy for the courts to interpret these issues. One, it is the courts themselves, the concourse, who came up with that ruling where they nullified the elections for Malandi and for Lusambo. And they did not indicate whatsoever in their ruling that we have disqualified the two. There is a very big difference between nullification and disqualification. You can't nullify a person, Peter. A person can never be nullified. You can only nullify the process. A person can only be disqualified.
Boman Lusambo is a former parliamentarian from Kabushi constituency. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Still in Zambia, an investigation carried out by the local chapter of Transparency International has uncovered acts of corruption in the Ministry of Finance. The anti-graft organization says it has officially petitioned the ministry to take action to prevent the embezzlement of public funds. It comes as President Hakainde Hichilema reiterated his commitment to the fight against corruption, promising to ensure transparency in the process. As a result, several former public officials have been invited by anti-graft agencies for questioning over their alleged involvement in fraud and other illegal and unethical behavior. For more on the latest on the investigation into act of corruption at the Zambia Ministry of Finance, I reach Maurice Nyambi. He is the executive director at Transparency International in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
This is part of the investigative work that we have been involved in. We have a project under which, we are looking at aspects of public finance management. And within the context of that project, we have had some training of investigative journalists, because the idea is that we would like them to begin to do a lot more of such investigative pieces, which would serve to input into our broader advocacy agenda on a whole range of issues, but specifically to do with public finance management. So within that context, we did undertake this investigation on the basis of some tips that we received concerning this, and our work around that tip actually revealed that there is an existence of some network of some sort, a very intricate network of organized looting that has been happening within the Ministry of Finance.
When you brought this up to the Ministry of Finance, How has been their response? Because the government under this current administration is on a crusade to stamp out graft.
Yes, indeed. The government really has stated from the onset that the anti-corruption agenda is an agenda that they support wholeheartedly. So even in exposing this wrong that we have discovered, I think we are doing it within the context and with a belief and a sincerity that this is something that is going to be received with open arms, and that it is something that is going to point to specific weaknesses and specific failures within the system that have allowed, for this anomaly to continue for so long. So we did reach out to the Ministry of Finance prior to, to the expose being made in the media. We did write formally to them, but we have not yet received a formal response to our letter.
In the investigations, were there other ministries where this cartel, so to speak, has been operating?
The indication that we got was that, this may not have been exclusive to the Ministry of Finance. But I need to mention that as at yet, we have not yet verified that assertion. So I think it would be folly of me to, categorically say that this is happening in other, ministries or other government entities. But I need to mention that we did get some indication that, it may not be exclusive to this ministry, but it is not something that I can categorically say as a fact at this point.
Are there any measures or mechanisms that could be implemented at the Ministry of Finance to ensure more transparency or sanitize the system in order to prevent future occurrences where public funds are being siphoned?
Yes, indeed, Peter. I think that is a very important and critical question that you have raised. And in answering it, let me just also say that our motivation or our motive for doing this expose is not really that we want to paint anyone black or we want to paint anyone in a particular picture. But I think our motivation and desire is that this would trigger the sort of reform that we have always called for in terms of, dealing with issues of corruption. We have always been of the view that the corruption problem that Zambia has, and that Zambia has grappled with for quite a long time now, is being facilitated and maybe even, enhanced in many ways by the systemic failures that exist in many a government entity. And I think what this investigation has shown is that there are failures within the system that are allowing for this sort of impunity and looting to actually happen. And so we are very confident that one of the first steps that needs to be taken in order for us to begin to see some sort of measures and some sort of interventions that will be put in place is the very steps that we have taken, the fact that we have exposed this and brought it out to the public. So the hope now is that this will trigger a series of interventions that the Ministry of Finance is going to put in place, all hovering around the fact that it is vitally important to adhere to the principles or to the provisions of the Public Finance Management Act of 2018, because ultimately that piece of legislation actually provides a very good framework and very good parameters that will ensure that we do not lose public funds in the manner that has been shown in this expose.
Maurice Nyambi is the executive director at Transparency International in Zambia. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In South Africa, a recent survey shows a majority of Africa's youth want action to stop gender-based violence. The market research carried out in a survey by the Ichikowitz Family Foundation shows 81% of young Africans expressed strong concerns about ongoing gender-based violence and femicide. The concerns were the highest in Kenya, 93%, and Zambia, 91%, while 81% of South Africans registered concern, with 7 in 10 respondents suggesting that they were very concerned. Young people also say that there does not appear to be enough protections for women's rights on the continent. For more on the survey, I reach Busi Nkumbuze. She is the head of the youth office at the Ichikowitz Family Foundation.
We have a Pan-African Youth Survey. It's a first of its kind in the sense that it's an in-depth exploration of how young people across the continent view themselves and the world around them. And it's in 15 countries. The face-to-face interviews comprise more than 4,500 youth voices. And so it is an authoritative source in terms of understanding the opinions and ambitions of young people. And specifically what we find they're saying, I think 81% is an extremely overwhelming majority, is that they are concerned about ongoing gender-based violence and femicide on the continent. They're concerned about gender equality and the rule of law in regards to the protection of women's rights. And we see these being expressed from a range of countries, obviously in varying levels of intensity. So some governments are doing better than others. But generally, the sentiment across the continent is that we need to take action to demand that women be protected and that their rights be provided to them.
In the survey, what accounts for this gender-based violence? Are traditional beliefs and systems contributing to this challenge?
I think it's different for different countries. I think, but generally what we can see, I think this is a global phenomenon as well, is that women have always been on the backseat of society owing to just the system of patriarchy that exists worldwide and is not necessarily an African phenomenon. But I think what you see in Africa in particular is a challenge with getting law enforcement agencies to really take a stand in terms of making provisions to protect women and to act on instances of discrimination that lead very much to harm. And this is well seen and demonstrated in the kind of femicide statistics that you see in countries like South Africa, like Kenya, like Zambia. And so it's really an issue at this stage of if I try to pin it down, of law enforcement.
Can education play a role in trying to find a solution to this problem?
Definitely. You know, if you think about what the point of education is, it's to conscientize, it's to make people alive to the true values to which our society ought to run. It's to shape people and what they should believe and how they should think and approach the various problems that we face in society. And so education has a strong role to play in essentially closing the chasm between what we say we want to do when it comes to gender equality and the enforcement of women's rights and what the reality is on the ground in our communities, where people are often educated, people are often illiterate, people are often living within cultural and social norms that are outdated and challenged. And so what education does in that context is it charges young people to sound the alarm when they do see things that contradict what we know to be right when we look at what we know is human rights, and specifically the rights of women.
Busi, what role do you think society can play, and the government as well, to try to eliminate instances of gender-based violence in their respective countries?
If we're starting with government, obviously there's a huge role to play because they are the law enforcers. They hold the monopoly on violence. They can take the strongest action in terms of limiting what people are able to do in terms of domestic abuse contexts, in terms of just what happens in the household or in the workplace. You look, for example, at a country like Rwanda, where youth feel that they're fairly equal before the law. And so even there, the sentiments around gender-based violence being a huge issue, it's just not as pronounced as a country like Congo Brazzaville, Uganda, where people feel that in general, you know, they don't feel equal before the law. And that's primarily a government responsibility. Are our countries truly democratic? Do our law enforcement agencies and institutions truly make people feel that they're equal under the law and that they will all get the provisions of justice necessary for them should they be in an instance where they're victims of abuse, they're victims of rape, victims of discrimination, even in the workplace?
Busi Nkumbuzi is the head of the youth office of the Ichikowitz Family Foundation. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. The Sierra Leonean government is expressing its condolences to families whose relatives were killed in the recent protests that turned violent. It follows the burial of police officers who recently died following clashes with protesters 2 weeks ago. Local media reports at least 21 protesters and 6 officers were killed during recent demonstrations in parts of the country, including the capital Freetown. The demonstrators called on the government to find solutions to the sharp rising cost of essential commodities and fuel, key among the challenges facing the country. But the protests quickly turned violent after the crowds destroyed property, including government offices and buses. The government says the violence prompted the security forces to respond with tear gas to stop the destruction. Officials also say the protests appear to be a plot to overthrow the administration in Freetown. For the latest development, I reach Mohamed Rahman Souare, the Sierra Leone's Minister of Information and Communications.
Following the dastardly assault on the eastern part of the capital on the 10th of August in a bloody insurrection, government on Tuesday gave a befitting funeral to the 6 service police officers who died in the course of duty. But civilians also died during the same attack. So government has put out public service announcements calling on those who lost loved ones in the course of August 18 to come forward to the central mortuary to identify the remains of their loved ones. So that announcement is ongoing. We look forward to receiving those relatives. Government is committed to providing psychosocial support, and together we'll determine the next course of action, including autopsy and the nature of burial that will be granted there.
Does that mean that the government will also consider helping with the burial of these deceased individuals?
Well, President Bio is a very compassionate person. In a recent meeting, he confirmed he values every Sierra Leonean life. So he has committed to ensuring that they too will be given a dignified burial.
The president also promised to establish a team to investigate these actions that led to the death of the police officers as well as these unarmed civilians. When should Sierra Leoneans expect this commission to begin its work?
Well, actually, yesterday, through the Office of the Press Secretary, His Excellency officially appointed people from various walks of life to constitute the committee to undertake a full-scale and comprehensive investigation into the causes of the riots, where it is established that it was funded by politicians without a message, faceless politicians, to get to the depth of that and make appropriate recommendations to government. So far, the composition of the committee has been roundly commended because it represents people from various walks of life. So the committee will begin work in earnest.
What is the time frame that the president gave the members to accomplish this task?
I have a feeling the committee will self-regulate itself. In their inaugural meeting, they will look at the volume of responsibility and determine when that will be brought to a close. But there is a sense of urgency, even among committee members I've spoken to, because everybody is yearning to see this report. The government is interested in reading it, so too are members of the public. So I have a feeling this will be a rush but very diligent job.
Well, Mohamed, some people are saying that those responsible for the deaths of the police officers and these unarmed civilians should be punished according to the law. Is this what the government is going to do?
Definitely. His Excellency, during the funeral rites of the 6 police officers who were killed, underscored the fact that this is a country of law and order, and that anybody who had a hand in the bloody August 10 violence, no matter how remotely, will be brought to justice. And he used that occasion to call for reconciliation, peace, and unity, while at the same time warning those who need warning and reassuring members of the general public that his government will not sit idly by and see any group of people torpedo the government.
Well, some people are saying that your government boasts of the freedom of speech as protected by the Constitution, and they fear that with this latest round of attacks that the government described as an insurrection to overthrow the administration, they fear that there could be a clampdown on free speech and the gains that the government has made could be reduced. What is your reaction to them?
This government is very committed to consolidating the gains to have made thus far. We have, like you very well know, under President Bill, he has repealed the criminal libel law. He has abolished the death penalty. He has a bill currently in parliament to empower women to a 30% quota representation. There are a lot more things we have done. So, traditionally, Sierra Leone leaders are not used to announcing election dates. They have only done so in the past under pressure, either from civil society, the international community, or within their parties. At this time, he has unveiled that together with the Electoral Commission way in advance of the election. So his message is simple. Those who are desirous of unseating him should use the ballot rather than use civilians or whatever mechanisms to unseat him before time. There is no vacancy at the moment at State House, he says.
Mohamed Rahman Soare is Sierra Leone's Minister of Information and Communications. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In Nigeria, supporters of the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, are expressing concern about reports of divisions within its leadership ahead of next February's general election. They say failure to unify the party could derail its electoral prospects. Local media reports officials of the ruling All Progressive Party, or APC, are making overtures to entice disaffected members of the opposition to join their ranks before the vote. Analysts say the main opposition could win the presidential election if they go to the polls united. Failure to do so, they argue, will make it easier for the APC to win. To learn more about efforts by the PDP's quest to unify, I reach Kola Ologbodiyan. He is one of the top leaders of the main opposition party.
I will start by saying that there are no such grave divisions within the People's Democratic Party. But I also agree that members are expressing concerns about the issues arising from the national convention and the nomination of the vice presidential candidate. However, it gladdens the heart to also inform you that concerted efforts are being put on, as we speak currently, to put all these issues behind us and to focus on the 2023 election, in which the Waziri Adamawa Atiku Abubakar is the candidate of the People's Democratic Party.
So how soon will your supporters see these efforts being made to reconcile the party, to unify the party ahead of the elections?
It is manifestly clear that the activities of the People's Democratic Party are largely put on the front burner for every member to see and to understand. And I am aware that the candidate itself has taken the sole responsibility to ensure that he rallies everybody into the party and make sure that going to the election as one indivisible and indissoluble political party, the People's Democratic Party. As you and I are speaking, there are reports, and I've also confirmed some of the reports, that the candidate, the Waziri Adamawa Atiku Abubakar, and Governor Yesom Wike, the Governor of River State, are meeting or they're about to meet at this time to dissolve all gray areas.
Some of your supporters are saying that the upcoming election next year in February is yours to lose. Others are also saying that overtures being made by the ruling party to try to woo some of your party bigwigs, so to speak, is an indication that they intend to weaken your party ahead of the election. Do you think these overtures to unify the party will make any significant progress?
Clearly, within the political firmament, people have interest in poaching members of other political parties, particularly in developing political system like we have in Nigeria. But the assurance I want to give is that I believe that the stakeholders of our party, who the APC are making overtures to, are not going to fall for those overtures. Because these are leaders who have made huge contributions to the development of the party, particularly in the last 7 years. And I do not expect, under any guise, for them to throw their investment, their support, their general support for the party, to throw it overboard just because of a presidential nomination or a vice presidential nomination. I believe strongly that parties are not created for a day. Parties are created for today, for tomorrow, and the day after. And as such, whatever is not attainable today can still be attainable at any other time.
Some political analysts are projecting that your party might not necessarily make it to over 50% based on the rising popularity of your former vice presidential candidate, Peter Obi, of the Labour Party, and that possibly an alliance with him could make the PDP certain winners of the presidential election next year. What are your thoughts?
There's nothing bad with alliances. And I personally believe a trajectory to the 2023 election has not been completed. And I believe that the former vice presidential candidate of our party, who is in the Labour Party today, if you look at the arena and you look at and examine the political firmament, and you can see clearly that there might be no pathway for him. So there's nothing wrong if he chooses to return to his political party, because that's where he has been. He was a vice presidential candidate in 2023. But the assurance I want to give is that I am confident that with the outlook of the political terrain as we speak, Atiku Abubakar will win the presidential election in February 2023. And I have no doubt about this, because the All Progressives Congress in the last 7 years has completely mismanaged the nation.
Kola Ologbodiyan is one of the top leaders of the main opposition party. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, a civil society group has welcomed an agreement signed between the government in Abuja and Washington to return $23 million recovered from the late military ruler, General Sani Abacha. The African Network for Environment and Economic Justice says it plans to be part of the process to independently monitor the disbursement of the recovered fund and the projects the monies will be used for. The agreement between the two countries, Nigeria officials say, is due to negotiations between the country, the U.S. State Department, and the United Kingdom's National Crime Agency. Reverend David Ugolo is the executive director of the civil society group and leader of the Monitoring Transparency and Accountability Project. He's calling on Nigeria's Attorney General to make public the agreement signed between Nigeria and the United States. For more reaction about the recovery of the $23 million, I reach Reverend David Ugolo.
Well, first, I welcome it because we think this is a demonstration of leadership by the U.S. government. Again, it like they say, put your mouth where your money is. What the U.S. government have done is to put life to the Global Forum on Asset Recovery Principle. If you recall, in 2017, the U.S. and U.K. government convened an asset recovery forum in Washington. At that forum, an historic agreement was reached with Nigerian government and Swiss government that led to the Abacha II, which is the $321 million that was returned to Nigeria in 2017. Now, 5 years down the lane, the U.S. government again have again shown that they are leaders on issue of asset recovery by returning another tranche of $23 million after the $311 million that was returned, which was the Abacha III. Now, this is Abacha 4, which the U.S. government have returned now. And what the U.S. government have done with this return, they made it explicitly clear that there was not going to be any compensation for any lawyer. And they want the entire money to go back to the victim, which is the Nigerian people.
It is understood that civil society groups, including yours, will monitor the disbursement of this fund. How will this act as a check and balance and to ensure transparency in this process?
We have history for doing this. That's why we launched the MANTRA model. The MANTRA model is an acronym for Monitoring Recovered Assets Through Transparency and Accountability. It's a framework we designed. We were able to recruit about 200 civil society across the entire country to monitor the Abacha 2, which is $321 million. And in the monitoring, we're able to track the money movement from Central Bank of Nigeria down to the beneficiary across the entire country. As we speak, a groundbreaking record was reached on this. Over 1.9 million poor Nigerians benefited from that tranche of money. And that was possible because of the MOU we entered into with the federal government that guarantees us access to data on how the money we are moving from Central Bank to the beneficiaries across the country. For us, it was a landmark compared to Abacha 1, when we discovered that people money released, what they claimed that they used it for didn't happen. And I think that Abacha 2 was an improvement on transparency and accountability. And I do hope that with the experience the federal government of Nigeria have gained so far, with the disbursement of the Abacha 2, that will have an impact on Abacha 3 and Abacha 4.
The agreement says this amount of money will be used for infrastructure projects. Specifically, what infrastructure project will these support?
Now, there are three major infrastructure projects, which they call the presidential infrastructure project. One is the Abuja Kano Road. The other one is the Niger Bridge. And the other third one was the Lagos-Ibadan Road. These are the three major projects across the country that the federal government is putting in these resources.
What is next after this latest tranche of money that will be repatriated to Nigeria for these infrastructure projects? What is next after this? Because I understand there are still a lot of money stashed away in foreign banks by General Sani Abacha.
We hope that, as you know, the U.S. government in December will be hosting the U.S. African Leadership Summit. And one message that we African civil society will be bringing before the U.S. government is for the U.S. government to continue to maintain their leadership in ensuring that illicit financial flow from the continent is stopped. Because without that, you cannot talk about democracy in Africa. Without resources to finance budgets, you cannot talk about democracy, because the rate of the impact of corruption in the continent is very damaging. And the only way to resolve this problem is for U.S. and other Western country government to rise up to the challenge by taking the full step of the U.S. government in repatriating some of these amounts that are stashed in Western Bank and return them back for financing development in the entire continent. Mm-hmm. You could imagine the impact of $23 million on the Nigerian economy at this point in time, particularly against the background of the crisis, the health crisis in the continent, the lack of resources. So to have $23 million at this point in time is really, really, really helpful.
Reverend David Ugolo is the Executive Director for Africa Network for Environment and Economic Justice. He spoke with me from Benin City, Edo State, Nigeria. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, wildlife authorities in Botswana say more than 50 white-backed vultures found dead in a national park recently had their body parts removed and were likely used for medicinal purposes. For viewing, Kodisi Dube reports from Botswana's capital, Habaroni.
Wildlife authorities in Botswana say more than 50 white-backed vultures found dead in a national park recently had their body parts removed and were likely used for medicinal purposes. Botswana and South Africa recently reported the death of more than 150 white-backed vultures after they fed on poisoned buffaloes. In both instances, the birds' body parts were removed. BirdLife Botswana Chief Executive Mutiragane Kutswisise says it is the first incident of its kind reported in the country.
For the first time in history, we witnessed a situation whereby the dead vultures had missing body parts. And from the scene, we observed that the head, the feet, and internal organs were removed by a sharp object we suspect to be a knife. But we are not sure whether this was done by locals or those poachers who seemingly targeted a buffalo. We suspect that it was opportunistic to extract those vultures' body parts.
Recent studies have shown that the birds are used in traditional medicines, particularly in southern Africa.
We cannot exclude the possibility of, intentional killing to take the vulture body parts. That is highly possible, especially that, studies in other countries in Southern Africa, show that traditional practitioners here, use some of the vulture body parts, such as a head, brain, claw, beak, and feathers, to heal human ailments.
Kutsusitse says more than 2,000 vultures in Botswana have been killed over the last decade, and BirdLife has been working to raise awareness.
BirdLife has been doing a lot in the area, with regards to public education on vulture conservation, but it's proving that there is obviously more help or assistance that is required in any way that is possible to join hands, not just locally but internationally and regionally as well, to basically fight the decline or any action that is supporting the decline of vulture population in Botswana and the region.
The white-backed vulture is on the International Union of Conservation of Nature's red list of critically endangered bird species. More than 500 in Botswana were poisoned in 2019. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Bang bang. why you dumb it? Kiki, I'm in love, and it's the way you're doing it. Why? It's the way you're doing it. You're not ready at all, ready for all. This unconditional love I got for you. This love I got for you. You're not ready at all, ready for all. This unconditional love I got for you. This love I got for you. No woman, no cry. Walk for a thousand miles, but you say you're tired of walking. In a ring with your talk of thing, me a fall back, cause in a harder. You're not ready at all, ready for all. This unconditional love I got for you. This love I got for you. You're not ready at all, ready for all. This unconditional love I got for you. This love I got for you. Deleting your conversations. Why you so hard, boy? You a must miss on. Oh, why? Why you so caught up living the hype life? Party day and night. 40 days and night. This unconditional love I got for you. This love I got for you. You're not ready at all, ready for all. This unconditional love I got for you. For you. You're not ready at all, ready for all. This unconditional love I got for you. This love I got for you. No, I can't have your back. But you will get treatment like that. You ain't ready. You ain't ready. No, I won't have your back. And I ain't coming back. Nah, you ain't ready for me.
So hadithi za babu yametokea darani Mtogole, yameniacha mkavu na moto wa uchungu kole. Sura sauti mlokole, nisha mchezesha upatu, naweka mwenge wa kula nale. Minangangana kujenga mwenzangu anaribu, yasnura majanga na yaona kila siku. Abadilisha waganga niroge niwe bubu, kushikia na mapanga ugombi sio ishu. Mwezi nituwe kwani na bara wanazo tetesi uwe kipara mawakwi terasi umba gumbala bora mpoze keshi ani uwe nituwe hey, nituwe hey, nituwe haibu nituwe zamani squeezy drama na ushindani wengi walinita baby baby wengine hani na mwisho wake penzi huwaga mtihani na
Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Nadia Taha, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how big a child is, he cannot deny that he was once carried on the back of a woman. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.